Session number 8939, Captain Ian Homerton, reel 16.
After we sorted out that frontier, we were then moved north of Hanover to a little village called Wittingen. It was between Lüneburg and Gifhorn, in Kreis Gifhorn. And it was right on the frontier. The frontier was in fact about a mile down the road to the east. And our duties there were simply to just to be there, I think, that we were a presence. I don't think we actually had to patrol. We may have done to start with, but I was never involved in it. I was sent on an advance party to get some billets organised, which we did, and we were all in billets there. I think it's worth mentioning a sort of personal thing. I was going around with our quartermaster, SQMS Hislop, looking at various houses, and I came to one, and a girl opened the door, and we said, "We want to come in and check this over for a billet." She spoke a little English, and her mother was this short lady looking very, very anxious indeed when she heard military boots scraping on her doorstep. And we were ushered into the sort of front parlour, and I noticed that they were putting some curtains up when we called. And we were talking about billeting soldiers and how many, and they said yes, they were sleeping down in the cellar, and yes, they could have the house and so on. And I said, "Well, what's the trouble here?" And she said, "Well, we can't reach to put the curtain up." So I said, "Have you got a newspaper or a piece of paper?" She looked at me and gave me a piece of paper, and I put it on the chair and stood up and put the curtains up for them. And that rather shook them, I think. Now, strangely enough, when the squadron moved in there, or the regiment moved in there, I met the girl again. And when the non-fraternisation ban ended, we used to go for little walks together, and they were just little walks, I might say. On one of them, I found in the sidings of the railway there some cattle trucks with straw in, which had obviously been used for shifting deportees or concentration camp victims or something like that. But otherwise, it was a very innocuous little place. And this young lady, Inga, Inga Ahrens, spoke quite good English. Her father had been killed earlier on in the war. He'd been a major in the army, I think. Anyway, it was a friend, sort of a friendship that sprang up. While there, the regiment was gradually run down, and we received a lot of the 4th, 7th personnel who were due for early demob. Our early demobs were moved on to the 4th, 7th because they were going on. the war in Japan had not yet finished. I was made education officer, and I had to organise various training courses. We organised courses in German, in English, in carpentry. There was a big wood yard, a sawmill there, bricklaying, motor mechanics, all sorts of things like that for people who were sort of preparing to go back to Civvy Street and wanted to, it kept them out of mischief for a start. Didn't have much dealings with the German population. We took over a house. I think it was there that I came across a girl a refugee, Ursula, somebody or other, who came from near the Harz Mountains. She was a refugee. And she spoke excellent English, and we got her vetted by the authorities. I think they had to take her down to Gifhorn or send her down to Gifhorn. And she became an official interpreter. Anyway, shortly after that, I was shifted to 43 Div headquarters as a staff officer in the A branch. And I went to Celle, and we were in billets in some very nice houses in Celle. And my duties there were to organise privilege leave. There was by now a train service running from Hanover across the Rhine Bridge that was built, that I mentioned, right through to the Hook of Holland. And it was a question of allocating so many seats, I think there were 350 seats or whatever, on the train, and all the units in 43 Div area, which was, it included a vast number of units, give them, make sure everybody had their fair turn of privilege leave. Also organising leave to the Bad Harzburg Spa, which I never went to myself. I also had to deal with courts martial, and I remember going and standing at the general's elbow. He was a bit of a fire eater. I think it was Barker, General Barker, I think. Who had to review some men who'd been condemned to death for desertion or some serious misdemeanor. And it was one of these things that kept coming up for a review. I don't think anybody ever made a final decision. It just kept coming up for a review while I was there anyway. The chief of A staff was a Lieutenant Colonel McConnell, who was a very nice chap indeed. Very helpful. He wanted me to stay in the army. Military secretary, staff officer was Ian McNaught Davis, another very interesting person, and others. And the other jobs I had were to help with the administration of some of the courts, courts martial, the war crimes trials. Now the division had already dealt with the first Belsen trial, and the second Belsen trial I got involved with, and it was a matter of organising. First of all, checking through thousands of written depositions that had been collected from inmates. And that was harrowing. Some of them were children. Some of them had been born in other concentration camps. And organising the correct interpreters from the interpreters pool, Hungarian, Czech, Polish, you name it, they were wanted.
Were the depositions then all translated into English?
They're all translated into English. Yeah, we had translations. Pages and pages and pages. Some of them were no more than a few sentences. Also, seeing that the court room was ready and that guards were available, refreshment for the judges, accommodation for the judges, all those sort of administrative details. I can't remember very much about the trials. I did poke my nose in the court a couple of times. The prize exhibit in the second trial was one of the women, woman guards, whose name escapes me at this moment. Ilse Koch, was it? Something like that. Anyway, she was a nasty bit of work. We also dealt with one or two other smaller trials, and I can't remember the details at all. And the last one that I was involved with was General Student from the Cretan airborne officer. Again, I didn't see the finish of that because I left. Although I was DOV'd for 1 year, otherwise I'd have been out much sooner.
Who was in overall charge of running these trials then?
Well, I can only imagine it was BAOR headquarters, and they were farmed out. I can't imagine we were the only people dealing with it. But BAOR was at Bad Oeynhausen, wasn't it, near Bonn. 30 Corps probably dealt with them all in our area, and they passed out to us at 4-3 Divitt Cellar. It involves going up to... The first Belsen trial was held in Lüneburg, but the others were held in Celle itself.
Who were the judges?
Part of the Judge Advocate General's department, but I can't remember any names, I'm afraid.
It seems that you were involved really in a mixture of legal and administrative duties, because if you were checking the depositions...
Well, I think that was mainly to find out the various languages that were required from the point of view of interpreters. Not anything more than that, as far as I can remember. Also, I was involved with some couple of courts martial in laying them on, and I had to take a court of inquiry. I remember somebody in an armoured car ran off the road and ran over a child, which fortunately came out the other side unscathed, but it did smash into a building and demolish the building, and there was a court of inquiry on that. There was also a court of inquiry into a man, another rank, who fell out of a bedroom window one night and landed in the garden and broke his neck. Remember that? So there was that side of it as well. Very interesting.
Did you find this work enjoyable?
Yes, I did. Well, enjoyable. I found it very, very interesting. Yes, it was totally different to anything I'd done before. I found it very interesting. Then coupled with that, somehow I got involved with the church there. One of my brother officers on A branch was a keen churchman, and the garrison church was, I think, one of the main parish churches in Celle, and we had a morning service every Sunday, and I used to go and sing in the choir with that. And I think out of that and connection with the Church of Scotland canteen, which was in Celle, I got very friendly with Padre McQueen. He was a Hebridean one-armed chap with a grip, left-hand grip, that just about crushed your fist. Marvellous man. And he organised some 20 question quizzes and things like that for, keep the troops amused and so on, and I used to go and take part in those. And I went to his wedding. He married one of the women in the Church of Scotland, a little wisp of a girl, Elspeth. he was not exactly huge, but he was a well-built man with a very strong, and he'd look you smack in the eye, and she was a little wisp of a thing. And when they got married at a lovely place, I can't remember the name of it, but it was a house that belonged to Baron von Kram, the Wimbledon tennis champion. Beautiful place. Went there in the winter and had a wonderful game of snowballing, I remember. And also in the spring, when just before I actually left, a few days before I left to come home on DMOB. Now, the other thing is that While I was walking through Celle one day, I bumped into young Inga Ahrens from Whittingham, and she'd come back to school there, and she was living somewhere in Diggs there, and so she used to come along to the church service too, and we'd started a youth club from the Church of Scotland canteen. I used to go along and help with that, and she came along to that, and we became very friendly. And it also took me out to one of the German prisoner of war release centres, which was just outside Celle, and I went along there to keep an eye on that a few times, see how they were getting on, because that was also part of our duties, was the release of German POW back into Civvy Street.
How were your relations with the local German authorities?
I didn't have any direct contact with the German authorities as such, but one of the... Inga moved to... She had to move out of a house where she was living. I think it was being taken over by the army. And she moved into some people called Koch. Now, they were called Koch. And Mrs. Koch and her husband, they were quite a youngish couple, and they were connected with the Hamburg Opera. He was an artistic chap. I think he'd not been in the German army at all. And Inga moved in with them. And I got quite friendly with them. I say friendly, but it was on a formal friendliness. Yeah, all this was on a formal friendliness.
It does seem odd how one moment you were on orders not to fraternise, and a short while later you were organising youth clubs. And
well, when the non-fraternisation ban was lifted, I think it was found that one of the best ways of re-educating the German people was to mix more and get these sort of things going. After all, there were quite a lot of... I remember reading a report on the situation in Land Hanover, that there was something like 14,000 children under the age of 13 just wandering around homeless and living off their wits or their bodies. It was a... You know, it was a frightful business. I also took some flute lessons. I've used to play the flute, and I thought it was an opportunity to practice again. And I've met I don't know how I met him, perhaps it was through the Kochs, a young German army flautist. He was in the German army headquarters band. And I used to go to his, house. He was living in one room of a two-story, maybe three-story house, with a different family in each room. And he gave me some flute lessons, which I paid for in cigarettes. I didn't smoke. He was very keen to get himself a piccolo, because without it he couldn't get a job in one of the orchestras that was at getting back underway again.
You mentioned the student trial. Did you see anything of student himself?
Do you know, I can't remember. I don't remember at all. Possibly not.
At any rate, he doesn't seem to have made a great impression.
No. I read a lot about it. I read a lot of the stuff, not because I had to, but because it was there and it was interesting.
How did you view your approaching demobilisation? Were you looking forward to it?
I was and I wasn't. As I say, I'd been DOV'd. Colonel McConnell asked me a number of times if I'd like to make the army a career, but I didn't fancy peacetime soldiering for various reasons. I felt I wanted to do something constructive, and I've done a lot of teaching in the army, instructing, and I decided that that's what I really wanted to do. I didn't want to go back to banking. I had called in at the bank several times on various leaves, and at the last one they tried to sell me the romance of banking, but it didn't appeal. And so I applied for an emergency training course, and I was accepted. I had to go for an interview somewhere. I think in Lüneburg I went, may have been Ulsan. And I was accepted, although later on I was given the opportunity of changing over to the normal full-time teacher training course, which I did. That's another story altogether.
Do you think you learned any particular lessons from your military experience, particularly the experience from D-Day onwards till the end of the war?
I suppose one does. One learns a lot more about oneself. I think I emerged as a much more confident person than I'd ever been before. I used to be very shy when I was a youngster, and my father stopped outside a sweet shop and said, "Here's tuppence, go and buy some sweets." I wouldn't dream of going in. I'm still rather shy, really. But much more confident, in fact. It's a bit of a paradox, but there it is. I had a much wider appreciation of life generally, I think, and of people. And one thing I did feel was important. I remember on that airfield in Belgium after the Breskens business, when we pulled back to that airfield, the Army Bureau of Current Affairs pamphlet came out about what was going to happen after the war, the Beveridge report and all that sort of thing. And I can remember then we had a discussion in the troop about what was happening after the war, and we all said it's going to be a great deal harder to win the peace than it is to win the war. And that has been so true. I think we've lost out a lot since, but you don't want to hear me philosophising about that. But I did feel in 1946 that I wanted to do something constructive as a result of what I'd seen. I mean, Hanover was a pile of bricks, and Hamburg was gutted buildings, and I'd seen a lot of bodies, and not just military ones, and some of the concentration camp too. I didn't actually go to Belsen myself, but it was in our area and I knew a lot about it, and I had seen the prisoners on our way up to Bremenvord from the other camp, and the one in Bremen too. While I was in Celle, the Malcolm Club, which was RAF, did have open house. Every weekend they had some sort of entertainment. It might have been the Hamburg Opera or the Niedersachsen Orchestra, mainly German ones. And I saw a lot of heard a lot of classical music and various operas there, which had an effect on me, and I suppose that's one of the reasons why I took up music in my teaching career. I don't think any of this has been wasted. Another person I met in as a result of the youth club was a young German who had been selected from as one of about nine from the whole of Land Hanover for training in the Führer School. And he'd fought, I think, have I mentioned him before? He had been, as a cadet, as a pupil, they'd been enrolled in the army when Germany was getting towards the end, and they'd been moved to Berlin on anti-aircraft defence. He'd been put into action as infantry against the Russians. His battalion had been pretty well massacred. He'd been captured. He'd escaped. He'd walked back from Russia through Czechoslovakia, Poland, through Germany. He'd passed through Dresden, if I remember rightly. He'd come through Hanover, and he'd come back to Celle, and he found his mother and his sister. And he invited me to his 17th birthday party. His mum and sister went in the woods and picked strawberries, and I took them a packet of biscuits and a bottle of lemonade. And his dad, who'd been a major in the First World War and was in the Arbeitsdienst and had been put in one of our holding camps, was released the day before, and he was there too. And there was his photograph with two candles and wildflowers, and it was a very emotional evening, And he spoke some English, and we talked, the boy, I mean, and we talked quite a bit. He came to the youth club, and he decided he was going to be a teacher. And he went to Heidelberg, I think, after the war, after it was all over. But the bottom had fallen out of his world, and he'd seen the results for himself.
Had he been a committed supporter?
Well, he must have been, otherwise he wouldn't have been chosen.
Did you find the transition to civil life difficult to accomplish when you came back?
Don't think so, not really, not particularly. No, but I've never lost those 7 years in the army, really. I mean, it's been in me all the time. I think it made me a better teacher than I might otherwise have been. I think the experience was useful. Quick one.
Is there anything else you'd like to mention?
Only about the German air raid on New Year's morning, 45. They assumed everybody would be drunk. They were probably right. And they came out in force. My squadron commander and I were in a scout car on our way to a special conference near Antwerp, and we saw plumes of smoke from every airfield that we passed, and German aeroplanes everywhere. We saw more there than we'd seen in the whole campaign so far. But as you probably know, they were all caught by non-destroyed Allied Air Force on their return from their forays. But it was quite an exciting morning, that was.